Lecture 16, The First Diffusion of the Dharma in Tibet.
For the last couple of lectures, we've been talking about the development of the tantric tradition in India, one of the last major forms of Buddhism to arise and expand and develop in surprising ways in the later years of the development of the Indian Buddhist tradition. Now, as you know, the tantric tradition began as a countercultural movement, really on the fringes of Buddhist society. It was associated with many practices that were impure, challenging, perhaps a bit dangerous in the traditional way of understanding religious practice in India. So we really have to think of it, initially at least, as a fringe movement. But before many centuries had passed, Tantra became an integral part of life in the Indian monasteries. It really became part of the mainstream practice of traditional Buddhism. In the later half of the first millennium of the Common Era, from about 600 to about 1200, tantric practices and teachings became part of the tradition of monastic learning. They were as much a part of the monasteries as they were of anything else. These monasteries had large libraries, colorful rituals, and an elaborate monastic curriculum, ranging all the way from Buddhist philosophy and meditation to tantric ritual and to astronomy and medicine. Unfortunately, their great strength as institutions also turned out to be a major weakness. When waves of Afghan raiders began to sweep down across northern India, down across the Punjab, and down across the Ganges Basin, the monasteries were tempting targets for plunder and for destruction. They were very rich. They were full of precious ritual objects. They had large libraries. And they really represented, in many ways, one of the most tempting manifestations of the wealth of classical India. By the year 1200, after two centuries of devastating invasions, there was little left of Buddhist monastic culture in northern India but a handful of destitute old monks. So if we want to continue our study of the Mahayana in the Indian style, we have to shift across the Himalayas to Tibet, where Indian monastic culture has been preserved more accurately and more richly than anywhere else in the Buddhist world. The first introduction of Buddhism to Tibet, it's known in the history of Tibetan Buddhism as the first diffusion of the Dharma in Tibet, began in the 7th century, right about the time when Tantra was beginning to manifest itself in the Indian Buddhist community. During the 7th century, a line of Tibetan kings who first appeared in a valley in central Tibet known as the Yarlung Valley brought the Tibetan tribes under some kind of unified government and began to extend their military influence out of central Tibet into the rest of Asia. And as they did this, they came into contact with China, of course, to the north and to the east, and with India to the south. And in both of these places, they found quite sophisticated Buddhist cultures. In the 7th century, China was going through one of the most prosperous and active periods in the history of Chinese Buddhism. The same was true, of course, in India, in the culture of the great monasteries. So these early Tibetan kings began to link themselves to the larger countries or cultures of Asia by beginning to adopt some of their religious practices, and Buddhism was a central part of what they encountered in these places. Now, only 100 years or so ago, we didn't know very much about what was going on in this early phase in Tibetan history. We have a few great chronicles that were written at a later period that tell us all sorts of marvelous stories about these early Tibetan kings, but there was not much firm historical evidence about their reign other than a few inscriptions that were found throughout central Tibet. Fortunately, about the turn of the 19th century, as the 19th century turned to the 20th, a series of travelers and explorers discovered caves in Chinese Central Asia that were full of remarkable historical chronicles that help us begin to piece together a picture of life in Tibet and in surrounding cultures, surrounding countries during this time. And we can now begin to speak much more confidently about the history of Tibet in these formative years when Buddhism was first entering Tibetan culture. According to the Tibetan Chronicles, King Songtsen Gampo, who reigned roughly from 609 to 649, invited one of his two Buddhist wives to help him introduce the cult of the Buddha to Tibet. What this meant was to introduce a statue of the Buddha in Tibet and establish the Buddha as a focus of worship. According to the stories, the first attempts to build a temple in the capital city of Lhasa were unsuccessful. The carts that were carrying the Buddha's statue bogged down in the swamps, and it was impossible for them to construct the temple that they had hoped to build. In a dream, the king was told that the land of Tibet lay on the body of a demoness who had to be subdued before the cult of the Buddha could be successfully established. So he ordered a series of temples to be built around the country that were understood as pinning down her knees and her elbows and her hips and her shoulders. Finally, a temple was built in Lhasa, in the center of the capital city, to pin down her heart. This temple is known as the Jokhang today. It's the most sacred temple in Tibet. It's the focus of Buddhist pilgrimage to the capital of Lhasa, and it is the site of the Jo-o Rinpoche, Songtsen Gampo's first Buddha image and the holiest image in traditional Tibet. Now, the actions of Songtsen Gampo, as you can imagine, not only subdued the demoness that constituted the Tibetan landscape, and you might say in some ways the subconscious identity of the Tibetan people themselves, but it marked Tibet with a form of a mandala that could be traced by pilgrims as they made their way from the fringes of the Tibetan plateau into this holy site in the center. Now, I should say, I think, as we begin to dig here into the history of Tibet, that a lot of the Tibetan names that I'm pronouncing to you will seem a bit unfamiliar and certainly nothing like what we have been talking about in our elaborate use of Pali and Sanskrit in our discussion of the Indian tradition. And I probably should tell you something just for a moment about the Tibetan language. I'll be using a pronunciation of these words that's something like the contemporary pronunciation, but the spelling of Tibetan was settled quite a while ago, shortly after the introduction of Buddhism to Tibet, and it's been standardized since that time. So the way we spell Tibetan is quite different than the way we pronounce it. If you have the written version of this course, you'll find in the glossary both the traditional spelling of the Tibetan names and also their modern pronunciations. If you want to imagine what the difference between them is like, you might just simply contemplate the difference between spelling and pronunciation of our word knight. You know, the knight in shining armor who came to rescue the fair maiden from the castle back there in the fables of our Western culture. If we pronounced what we write, it would sound like knicht, I suppose, something like that. But we pronounce it knight. A lot of Tibetan words are like this. They have very complicated spellings and very simple pronunciations. One of my favorite is the word B-S-G-R-U-B-S. I suppose if you pronounced it literally, it would be busgrubs. It means something like proven or established in a philosophical sense. It's spelled busgrubs, and it's pronounced de. And therein lies one of the great problems for a beginning student of the Tibetan tradition. In any case, what you're hearing from me is an approximation of contemporary pronunciation. Now, after the time of Songtsen Gampo, the next major series of events in Tibetan history occurred in the 8th century during the reign of another Buddhist king named Trisong Detsen. Trisong Detsen sponsored the construction of a monastery at Samye. This was the first Buddhist monastery in Tibet, and obviously it marked a major shift in the relationship between Tibet and Buddhism. The construction of the monastery required the help of the tantric saint Padmasambhava, also known in Tibet as Guru Rinpoche, or Precious Teacher. With his magic power, this tantric saint, Padmasambhava, subdued the demons that opposed the monastery's construction. And he's become the focus through Tibetan history of a tremendous amount of storytelling and outright myth-making. And it would be wrong for us, I think, to pass him by without giving an impression, at least, of the way he has been perceived in later centuries. David Snellgrove and Hugh Richardson, two remarkable Tibetologists who have an extraordinarily deep and sophisticated knowledge of this culture, have translated for us a passage from the legendary biography of Padmasambhava that gives us a sense, I think, of how large he eventually loomed in the Tibetan imagination. The passage starts with a miracle. After spending some time in Lhasa, Padmasambhava traveled to meet King Trisong Detsen, who was camped with his army in a barren valley. They had tried in this valley to find some water to make their afternoon tea, and as you may know, in Tibet, butter tea is one of the staple features of the staple foods, I suppose you should say, of the culture at large. It's really hard to exist in a traditional Tibetan culture without cultivating a taste for this mixture of butter, salt, and tea. In any case, they were making their afternoon tea, or at least trying to make it, and they couldn't find any water to do it. And up came Padmasambhava, and in a miracle that reminds you of some of the miracles in the Bible, he struck the rock, and out of the rock began to come the water that they needed to make their tea. So having established his miraculous presence, having made his powerful presence known, he then sat down and pondered how best to introduce himself to Trisong Detsen. The question that concerned him really was, how would they greet one another? Who would bow first and who would offer a kind of ritual submission to the other? How he considered this is made clear in this translation by Snellgrove and Richardson. Padmasambhava said, according to this legendary biography, "I am not born from a womb, but I was magically born. The king was born from a womb, so I am greater by birth. The name Padmasambhava means born from a lotus." The story about Padmasambhava is that he sprang from a lotus. "I am a religious king who ruled in the land of Urgen, a land that we now associate with what's called the Swat Valley in Pakistan and northern Pakistan. And my lineage is greater than the king of this evil land of Tibet. As for our two aspects, he's in a confused state of ignorance, while I'm skilled in all the five branches of learning. My Buddhahood was acquired in only one lifetime, and this king must certainly salute me first. But I wonder, shall I even bother to return his salutation?" This is the question that Padmasambhava asked himself. He decided, of course, that his dignity required him not to salute the king, so he would receive the king's salutation and not salute him back. The king, of course, decided that he ought to wait for Padmasambhava to salute him first, as befit his dignity as a king. So they're standing face to face. They meet each other. There they are, each one waiting for the other to bow down in salutation. In the silence, Padmasambhava spoke the following words: "The Buddhas of past, present, and future emerge from wombs, accumulating stocks of merit and knowledge throughout three long, incalculable world ages. But I, Padmasambhava, am the lotus-born, possessing the precepts of the insight that comes from above. I discourse fully on all the Buddha ways without confusion. I am the Dharma, which is lotus-born. Outwardly, I wear the saffron robes of a monk, but inwardly, I am the highest of tantric practitioners. After a few more verses like this, the king bowed down and asked Padmasambhava's forgiveness. Padmasambhava then told him to atone for his sin by constructing five new stupas, and Padmasambhava concealed a treasure in each one of them. Now, I'm fond of this story of Padmasambhava, not just because it tells you a little bit about the jousting about protocol that probably went on, at least at some stage in the Tibetan tradition, but because it reminds me of one of my most amusing encounters with the Dalai Lama. I'll say more about the Dalai Lama a couple of lectures from now, but I remember one time when he was making one of his visits to Cambridge, and my job was to go and pick him up at his hotel and convey him to the lecture hall where he was going to be speaking. And we, of course, got to the door of the lecture hall. Now, who should go in first? That's the question. Should it be this lowly junior professor from the university, or should it be the exalted Dalai Lama? Well, you know, in our culture, I think I'm right about this, we let the most senior person enter first. So I stepped aside and I made a gesture, and hoping that the Dalai Lama would go gently through the door, and he stepped aside and made a gesture for me to go through. Well, I didn't really know what to do at this point. So I laughed and I said to him, well, you know, in America, the most important person goes through the door first. And he said, well, you know, in Tibet, the least important person goes through first. And he laughed at me and he grabbed me by the arm and he said, well, then let's walk through the door together. It's one of my most pleasant encounters with him. And it struck me as being rather different than this encounter between Padmasambhava and Trisong Detsen. In any case, the relationship between the two turned out to be fairly close, and Trisong Detsen used Padmasambhava's help quite extensively in the early introduction of Tibetan of Indian monasticism to Tibet. King Trisong Detsen also needed the help of another specialist as well. Padmasambhava was good at tantric magic, at tantric, invoking the power of tantric meditation, but he wasn't necessarily a scholar. And for the scholarly curriculum of his new monastery, King Trisong Detsen had to turn to one of the representatives of the Indian monastic tradition, whose name was Shantarakshita. He was actually a Madhyamaka philosopher of the Swatantrika branch of that school, and he helped introduce to Tibet that sophisticated and complicated monastic curriculum that we spoke about in our discussion of Buddhist philosophy. And I think you could say that these two figures represent the two faces of Tibetan Buddhism, a reverence for the power of a tantric practitioner that has always been important in Tibetan history, right from the very beginning. It's still true today. Tantra is a living force in Tibetan society, and it manifests itself in a form of practice that's not unlike the practice associated with Padmasambhava. But there also has been in Tibetan culture an extraordinarily deep reverence for the practice of Buddhist scholarship, of Buddhist scholasticism, as represented by Shantarakshita. So if you want to study Buddhist philosophy in the form that I was discussing it a few lectures ago when we talked about the scholarly approaches to the doctrine of emptiness, Tibetan Buddhism is one of the best places to do this. That scholarly tradition is still alive, active, and flourishing in Tibetan monasteries. Now, the Tibetan tradition also tells us that Trisong Detsen sponsored a debate at Samye. He didn't just found the monastery, but he sponsored a debate to determine the character of Tibetan Buddhism. He brought in a Chinese religious specialist and an Indian religious specialist, and he set them up in a mode of discourse that would lead eventually to a conclusion about which variety of Buddhism would be best, as it were, for Tibetan culture. Representing the Chinese side was a meditation master whose name was simply Mahayana, who advocated a practice of sudden awakening, like the practice of sudden awakening that we'll discuss when we talk about the Chan and Zen traditions. Representing the Indian side was a disciple of Shantarakshatan whose name was Kamala Shila, who advocated a practice of gradual awakening, of slowly working yourself through the stages of the Bodhisattva path before you come eventually to the experience of Buddhahood. According to the Tibetan tradition, the king decided in favor of the Indian party and permanently oriented the Tibetan tradition toward India. So this was another watershed in Tibetan history when a Tibetan king chose Indian Buddhism as the source of the Tibetan tradition. Now you might, after the reign of Trisong Detsen, another king appeared whose name was Lang Dharma, who attempted to persecute Buddhism. He attempted to stamp out the practice of Buddhism in central Tibet. Now, he was not terribly successful in this. He was eventually assassinated, and the line of the Tibetan kings was broken. But the practice of Buddhism in Tibet went into eclipse. So there was no active support of the Tibetan monasteries and no active practice of Buddhism, at least in that organized way that we would associate with the monastic tradition. Now, you might well ask, in the case of Lang Dharma and his attempt to stamp out the practice of Buddhism in Tibet, where his opposition came from. Why would a king appear in this line of Tibetan kings after so much effort had gone into establishing Buddhism? Why would a king appear who would attempt to reverse that process and eliminate Buddhism from Tibetan culture? One traditional answer to this question would be to say that it came from the influence of an indigenous religious tradition found in traditional Tibet and known by the name of Bön, B-O-N, the Bön tradition. Bön is sometimes called the indigenous shamanism of Tibet, and its practices often involve a very conscious inversion of Buddhist practices. From a Buddhist point of view, it often seems quite challenging and dangerous. For example, when a Bönpo, a practitioner of Bön, goes to a stupa, instead of walking around it to the left so that the right shoulder is kept always toward the holiest place in the stupa, a Bönpo goes around a stupa to the right. So that the direction of Buddhist practices often is inverted in the practice of Bön. Buddhists find this challenging and a little bit strange, but from the point of view of Bön, this tradition represents the practice of Tibetan religion as it existed in Tibet before the coming of Buddhism. Very interesting claim. The Bön tradition traces its origin to a figure named Shenrab, who is called by Bön a Buddha, using the Tibetan name for a Buddha, Sangye. Like Shakyamuni, he has achieved this experience of awakening. But instead of coming from India to the south of Tibet, he comes from a region known as Tazik to the west of Tibet. Tazik is a region that I think we can loosely associate with Persia. Like Buddhism, the Bön tradition developed an elaborate canon of scripture, and many of the teachings in this canon are very close to the teachings found in Tibetan Buddhist texts. One text, for example, describes emptiness in a way that would be quite familiar to us from the other discussions we've had of this important doctrine. The elements of existence are like a dream or a mirage, it says. Their sole validity is their essential vacuity or their emptiness. This truth, which never came about, was never said to have been really taught. It is taught in the form of a metaphor, transcending sounds and terms or words. It cannot be taught for what it really is. Classic expression of emptiness, like the kinds of descriptions of emptiness that we would see in an Indian text. But they're also running through Burn texts like a strange undercurrent is a sense of opposition and hostility toward the Buddhist tradition, expressed in another text translated by Snellgrove and Richardson. Text says this: King Trisong Detsen, that king, he is a roguish fellow. His ministers are monstrous rogues. Our blazing light is now withdrawn. Now is the time of these Buddhist monks. The princes now have faith in gold, and our haloed burn declines. May that king, that Trisong Detsen, become a village beggar, and may his ministers become shepherds. May the land of Tibet break into pieces and these Buddhist monks lose their law. May these nuns bear children and these Buddhist priests lead fighting gangs. May their monasteries be filled with battle. May their temples be set on fire. And may my curse become effective. And may these books of mine be found by someone worthy. This is a strong and vindictive curse of the Buddhist tradition. It's found in the classic tradition of Burn. Now, in spite of these ancient curses, the Burn has now so thoroughly accommodated itself to Buddhist practices, and did so actually many centuries ago, that for many scholars, the Burn tradition is viewed as really nothing more than another variety of Buddhism. You can certainly approach it that way, even though it makes very strong claims to represent the indigenous tradition of Tibet and presents itself in many respects as a tradition in opposition to Buddhism. Now, you might ask one more question in talking about Burn and in talking about this early phase in the history of Buddhism in Tibet. What is it like these days to encounter a practitioner of the Burn tradition? Now, I would not normally pose a question like that. I don't know very many Burnpos, and I haven't made much of an effort to seek them out. But I do have one rather remarkable story to tell you that might give you a little bit of the flavor, not just of the power of the tradition, but also about how it incorporates Buddhist ideas. Once when I was sitting in my office at Boston University, I got a call from a fellow who said that he had a visiting Burnpo, visiting from India, and he was traveling around and speaking in universities. This man wondered whether I would like to have the Burnpo come and visit my classes. I said, sure, that'd be a great idea. It's not often that you get a chance to have a visiting black magician from Tibet come and address your class. So we set a day, and I waited for the fellow to come. And on that day, strangely enough, I'm actually not making this up. This may sound a little odd, but it actually did happen quite this way. That was the day of what's called the perfect storm, that great destructive storm that came in New England on Halloween, spun backwards down the New England coast and caused a tremendous amount of destruction. On that day, the wind blowing, the rain pouring into my office swept this red-robed Burn priest. We talked a bit. We then went over to my classroom, and he sat down and gave a very calm and quiet account of the Burn tradition that sounded an awful lot like Buddhism. He said, if you want to practice the Burn, have compassion on your neighbor, and also at the same time study emptiness, and you will in that way proceed to awakening. Then, as the windows were rattling and the rain was beating down outside, my students had a chance to ask him some questions. And they said, well, how was it you happened to become a Burnpo? How did you choose to enter this form of religious life? And he said, well, you know, My daddy used to be a great magician, and he would leave the body during the night and travel around Tibet. And when he came home for breakfast, he would tell us stories about all the things he saw. And I wanted to be a magician just like my daddy. The student's jaws dropped a little bit, and another person asked another question. Well, what happened to your daddy? Whatever became of him? And this Bunpo said very quietly, well, you know, one day he said to us that he needed to do an important meditation and we should lock the door to his meditation room and not disturb him for a week. During that week, there were meteor showers and there were strange comets and all that sort of thing. And at the end of the week, we opened up the door and there was nothing left of my father but a pile of hair and fingernails. And at this point, the students in the classroom, I probably was among the group, actually, their jaws dropped. The window frames rattled. The rain was pouring down outside. And I felt, for a moment anyway, that I had been transported into that remarkable and strange world of the Bön tradition. About the veracity of his story, I certainly cannot say much, although the claim he was making about his father is a very traditional claim about some form of Tibetan practitioners. But I was grateful to him for having introduced me into that world of the Bön tradition in such a powerful way.